Hello, and welcome to the Respiratory Care Editor's Commentary and Podcast for April of 2024. This is Rich Branson. I'm the Editor-in-Chief of Respiratory Care. Thanks for joining us. This month's Editor's Choice evaluates the accuracy of consumer-grade pulse oximeters in pediatric subjects compared to a medical-grade oximeter. Covici and colleagues studied a fingertip oximeter and an oximeter built into a smartphone in 74 children. They calculated the root mean square error as well as bias and precision of each device and the percentage of measurement failures. Smartphone oximeters failed to measure SpO2 in nearly 40% of cases. There were large differences between the medical oximeter, which was still just a simple fingertip oximeter, and the consumer-grade devices. Saturations read as much as 4% higher or 17% lower than the reference oximeter. Accuracy was impacted by both subject age and size and the type of oximeter. Wilson and Birkenbosch provide accompanying commentary, noting that the major limitation that the TRUSE test of accuracy requires an arterial blood sample. Of course, getting an arterial blood sample in pediatric patients for testing the oximetry probably was out of the question from a tolerance standpoint. They predict that use of these devices will continue to expand in the home and that inaccuracies may lead to delays in seeking treatment, particularly amongst infants. They encourage additional studies with a multitude of devices across a range of subject ages and clinically important SpO2 ranges. We've seen a number of these studies now with over-the-counter oximeters or smartphone oximeters or smartwatch oximeters, and they all are interesting and they might be fun, but none of them should be used for decision-making. Vieira and others describe a barrier enclosure for actively removing aerosols during treatment of subjects with contagious respiratory illnesses. The device was tested in healthy volunteers and in a model measuring removal of fluorescent microparticles and ambient carbon dioxide concentration. Usability was tested for performance of intubation and extubation by 5 anesthesiologists. A high-flow nasal cannula system was tested at 30 and 60 liters per minute with varying levels of enclosure suction pressures. Particle removal efficacy and safe breathing conditions, based on CO2 concentration and temperature in the chamber, were reached when suctioning was at least 60 liters a minute or 20 liters a minute above the high-flow nasal cannula flow. Jay Lee provides expert commentary based on her extensive research in this area. She emphasizes that concerns over environmental contamination during intubation, non-invasive ventilation, and high-flow nasal cannula at the genesis of the pandemic were overstated. Adding to a frequent refrain over the last decade in critical care, she suggests that often less is more. In this case, masks worn by the patient and the caregiver are likely sufficient at little cost and with few complications. This paper I still find interesting as it might be useful for transporting patients in ambulances or aircraft who have unknown respiratory contagions. But we've also seen that the head boxes that were developed during COVID-19 to protect the person providing intubation resulted in less successful intubation and more attempts. So again, we have to be careful what we wish for. Miller and co-workers detail the results of a quality improvement initiative and to define parameters associated with the successful extubation readiness test in children with congenital heart disease. In 780 extubation readiness tests, they found a successful ERT resulted in extubation in 58% of subjects with a re-intubation rate of 9%. ERT success decreased with increases in peak pressure, higher driving pressure, higher PEEP, mean airway pressure, and VDVT. Interestingly, they found that mean airway pressure was a better marker of success than PEEP alone. Napolitano and others contributed an accompanying editorial suggesting that the dichotomous bucketing of PEEP into only two levels might decrease the value of PEEP as a predictor. They suggest that in children with congenital heart disease, differences in criteria based on the type of cardiac lesions remain to be clearly defined. Kleinhendler et al. Compared standard pulmonary function testing and impulse oscillometry in a group of 61 subjects with unexplained dyspnea or as part of a preoperative evaluation. They found the resonant frequency was an independent predictor of abnormal FEV1 to FVC ratio. They concluded that impulse oscillometry performed similarly in standard pulmonary function testing and might have utility in patients unable to cooperate or those with dyspnea. Wong and others studied pediatric subjects with ARDS and evaluated respiratory support following extubation. post-extubation respiratory support and how it changed over time was recorded, analyzed, comparing subjects who received post-extubation respiratory support versus those who did not among pediatric ARDS severity categories. Oxygenation index and mechanical ventilation duration were higher in subjects who received a post-extubation respiratory support compared to those who did not. They reported that the majority of pediatric subjects with ARDS required some type of post-extubation respiratory support, many up until hospital discharge. In this case, post-extubation respiratory support could include non-invasive ventilation, CPAP, high-flow nasal cannula, or standard oxygen therapy. LaLouche and colleagues evaluated a new generation of heated humidifiers measuring delivered temperature and humidity at a variety of settings and variable ambient temperatures. They found that new devices routinely maintain the required absolute humidity in a majority of cases, regardless of the ambient temperatures. They conclude that the new humidifiers with advanced algorithms for management of ambient temperatures perform better than the legacy devices. Sabaz et al. Evaluated oxygen delivery via nasal cannula in realistic models of upper airway geometries from neonates to adults. Flows tested range from 0.5 to 65 liters per minute. Delivered FiO2 increased non-linearly with the ratio of oxygen flow to simulated inspiratory flow. They developed a new equation to predict FiO2, which matched measured values very closely. El-Khatib and others evaluated the impact of ventilator settings on the measurement of mechanical power in a lung model of ARDS. Using volume and pressure ventilation, they measured mechanical power values for simulated subjects with mild, moderate, and severe ARDS. If mechanical power exceeded 17 joules per minute, tidal volume, breathing frequency, or PEEP were manipulated independently to reduce mechanical power to less than 17 joules per minute. They concluded that volume ventilation with a constant inspiratory flow resulted in the lowest mechanical power. Manipulating tidal volume was the most efficient method for maintaining safe and protective mechanical power in this model. Zimmerman and co-workers performed a retrospective review of tracheostomy performed in subjects who required Guardian approval for the procedure. It's a study from Israel. Guardian approval was associated with a one-week delay in the timing of tracheostomy. The delay in timing resulted in a 50% decrease in the need for tracheostomy. In lieu of tracheostomy, a third of subjects were extubated, a fifth died, and a small number were transitioned to palliative care. They concluded that the ideal timing for performance of tracheostomy could be improved, reducing unnecessary procedures. Pouvier et al. Provide a short report on the evaluation of dependent areas of collapse measured using electrical impedance tomography during supine positioning in between periods of prone positioning. They found that even in subjects without an improvement in oxygenation, EIT demonstrated improved distribution of ventilation during prone positioning, which might be associated with a decreased risk of ventilator-induced lung injury. Sometimes we've seen that methods of mechanical ventilation or other therapies improve gas exchange, but do nothing for outcomes. Now we start to see that sometimes we make manipulations that don't really change gas exchange, but may result in a positive outcome for the patient, in this case, reducing the risk of ventilator-induced lung injury. Coccola and others provide a narrative review of the impact of obesity on ECMO. They reviewed 29 publications, which were predominantly retrospective reviews. They found no impact of obesity on mortality or complications in subjects receiving ECMO. They concluded that BMI thresholds for ECMO that are currently used cannot be supported. Chen et al. Provide a systematic review evaluating the use of nocturnal pressure-controlled ventilation compared to pressure support ventilation on sleep quality. They identified 4 trials involving 67 subjects and found that sleep efficiency was improved with pressure control ventilation. This is a simple matter of having a set rate versus the patient determining their rate. And this has been shown with pressure support in the past where patients breathe until they go below their CO2 apneic threshold. And then when the CO2 rises again, they have an awakening disturbing their sleep. In our continuing series on research and publication in respiratory care, Denise Willis writes an excellent paper on the peer review process. And Dean Hess provides a review of statistics for the non-statistician. We appreciate your interest in the journal Respiratory Care. We hope to see papers from you in the future, and thank you for your attention. To receive the content of this and past issues of the journal, visit our website at www.rcjournal.com.
There, you can also subscribe to receive podcasts of future issues.